Great to have you with us on WPR News. Larry Mueller here, and we're starting the show today by talking about the health of your digestive system with our guest, Dr. Siegfried Yu. He's a gastroenterologist with Amplify Health in La Crosse. And as we talk with him, I want to hear from you. What would you like to know about the way your digestive system works, maybe? Wondering how to get rid of constipation or maybe diarrhea is an issue. There are all kinds of things we can talk about with him today. And I hope you'll join in with your own questions or maybe your own experiences. Give a call. The number's 800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Or send an email to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Dr. Siegfried Yu, welcome to the show. Thank you for taking time to be with us today.
A pleasure to be here. Thank you, Larry. Love your show.
Thank you so much. You know, the digestive system, and I guess it includes several organs that turn food into energy. What are the most common digestive problems patients come to you with?
I would say definitely among them include constipation, acid reflux, irritable bowel syndrome, and related problems. And of course, on the other end of things, screening for colon cancer is extremely important. So
all things we can definitely talk about today. I'm sure there is a medical definition of constipation. What is that definition?
Generally, it's a perception of decreased bowel movement frequency and or difficulty evacuating stool. So that might mean different things for different people. Commonly, someone, you know, may have a normal bowel movement every day, but if they're having trouble evacuating, they may still be constipated. On the other hand, someone could have multiple bowel movements a day and might even have loose stool, but could have a problem emptying that can get a little bit more confusing. So it's not as straightforward as you would imagine. But generally, if someone has skipped 2-3 days of time without having a bowel movement, you know, and has trouble emptying, that's enough to classify them as having constipation symptoms.
I'll admit that sometimes when I go off on vacation or somewhere else, I might have that issue for a couple of days, and then it sort of rights itself. Is that one of the let me put it this way. What are the most common causes of constipation?
No, as you pointed out, a lot of those lifestyle factors can contribute. And using the example you cited, changes in setting like travel, you may not drink as much. You might not, depending on how you're getting to where you're going, you might not be moving around as usual. And as everyone knows, something that happens with travel and vacation, our diets change. So fiber intake can be something that we might not get as much of with vacation eating habits, among other reasons.
Yeah, so you're saying diet and hydration play a pretty big role.
Sometimes more than we realize it, and in many ways the standard American diet has become very fiber deficient. So apart from adequate water intake, you know, making sure that someone's dietary intake of fiber is, you know, kind of the next important thing as it relates to normal bowel habit.
So that would, I'm wondering on the remedy side, if you've got mild constipation, a simple at-home remedy?
You know, it all depends on, to some degree, the severity. In a situation like yours, that might correct pretty easily just by correcting the water issue. Mm-hmm. The problem is the longer one goes without having a normal bowel movement, the more difficult it can become to sort of correct those symptoms. And a useful analogy I commonly use when I see my patients in the clinic or in the hospital is the plumbing analogy. So the job of the digestive tract is in many ways to process the food we eat. Part of the role of the colon is to reclaim a lot of that water and remove the food residue that we have not utilized for nutrition purposes, and it forms stool. And of course, the job of the colon and, you know, that lower area of the body that we sometimes refer to as the pelvic floor is to remove that material. So when that clog forms, the longer it forms and the more chronic it becomes, the more difficult it is to unclog, so to speak. So if, depending on how symptomatic someone is, they might need some extra help with over-the-counter remedies if the simple things like water and fiber and activity have not fixed it.
So you, and I guess we're talking about laxatives here.
Mm-hmm.
So do you recommend using laxatives at home, maybe without advice from a doctor?
I would say not on a regular basis. And if anything, particularly depending on what someone's demographic is, say they're in an age range that is more appropriate for colon cancer screening interventions or strategies, and they've never had that done and they start to notice new problems with their bowel habit, you know, that might be more of an indication that they might need more evaluation and not put that kind of medical assessment off, you know, because although we hope it's never something more serious, sometimes those symptoms might represent something besides an innocent episode of constipation triggered by a lifestyle.
Yeah.
Of some kind.
You know, and those tests are, I mean, all right, they're a little bit of a pain to take the liquid and so forth, but they're, I've always found them to be pretty straightforward and pretty easy, colonoscopy screening.
And I would say for the majority of people, that's the case. Not everyone will tolerate them the same way. And, you know, of course, there's the psychological aversion just to testing in that area that's understandable for many, or they hear about you know, a bad experience someone may have had. But I would say more now than ever, we have the ability to make it a very comfortable experience for the majority of people. And even if it's not something one wants to jump into as far as, the colonoscopy itself, there are some tests that are available that are very good to use for screening purposes. That could be, you know, maybe a next best step, like stool testing, among others.
Yeah.
And I would say the although they're not easy to collect, it's better than not doing anything at all. And keeping in mind that an abnormal test will almost certainly result in a recommendation to get the formal test done.
Yeah.
So.
What are some, let's talk about food here a little bit too. High fiber foods, what are some of the best ones that can help with constipation?
You know, I would say generally the advice I give would be the more natural foods that one might consider part of what commonly, at least these days, may be described as a kind of a whole food approach. To a plant-based dietary strategies or plant-focused dietary strategies. So your fresh fruits and vegetables, whole grains are definitely going to be on that list. Minimizing ultra-processed food is key, I think, in general, as a principle, at least in modern society, as far as healthy choices, because they are everywhere and they're generally not going to be as healthy. So the more natural and less processed something is in general, as long as someone tolerates it, that's a good thing, of course, with adequate hydration, water intake. And, you know, on the other hand, some people might opt for fiber supplements, which are also somewhat ubiquitous.
Yes.
You know,
yes, they so are.
maybe less desirable, but you know, perhaps better than nothing as a place to start if someone does tend to have a diet, say that's higher in red meat and in Wisconsin cheese curds, and you know, things of that nature. They might not get very much fiber, apart from maybe a potato or something. But you know, for people that might have a dietary pattern like that, I'd say it's reasonable to use a supplemented fiber while they're trying to bridge the gap. And as far as adjusting some of the healthier whole plant-based dietary choices.
Yeah. I was thinking about myself. I'm sure I eat more fruits than I eat vegetables, partly because I bring a lunch to work, and I always have an apple, and I always usually have a couple of nectarines, maybe, or an orange, or cuties, as they call them. So I'm having that pretty much 5 days a week.
That's good.
Well, what about exercise? Does exercise play a role?
I would say it definitely does, and depending on one's baseline level of activity is, you know, that may or may not be something they need to adjust a whole lot. However, you know, just like the dietary patterns that have changed over time in our modern society, our health habits like exercise and activity has also become at risk. So what we commonly describe as the kind of sedentary lifestyle where we may not be moving a lot or exercising. Thankfully, we live in an area where there are a lot of trails, and I think in general people embrace the outdoors even in cold weather,
yeah,
which is, I think, a good thing in our region in Wisconsin. But I would say a place to start would, for those who might not be as active, and you know, we have to account for people that might have other health issues related to mobility.
Sure.
You know, that type of thing. At least walking, you know, perhaps 30 minutes a day, if one isn't getting much activity of other kinds, is a good place to start. So.
Alfred in Cottage Grove has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Alfred.
Hey, good morning. Thanks for taking my call. Products like Metamucil and Miralax, are they considered laxatives? And what about using them on a daily alternating basis? Is there a problem there?
That's a good question, Alfred. And both of the products you cited are very common. You can find them in almost any grocery store, pharmacy, convenience store. Miralax, which is a kind of a proprietary name for the compound polyethylene glycol, not to be confused with windshield washer fluid. Sometimes we get that question. It is what we describe, at least in medical jargon, an osmotic laxative. So it is a laxative in the sense. And when we say osmotic, basically it works in the body by passing through the body in the intestine tract in particular and not getting absorbed. So it holds the water that it's mixed with in a way that allows that same fluid that you've taken in to pass to the colon with the intention of making the stools softer and increasing their movement out of your body. Metamucil, on the other hand, while fiber, when we look at it, might in some literature get lumped in among the options for treating constipation, much in the way a laxative might be classified. Metamucil is actually, interestingly, goes by the chemical name psyllium husk, which is derived from corn husk, believe it or not. And so this is a fiber supplement that's, again, meant to some extent, bulk as well as pass through in a somewhat similar way. And then that might be helpful for people that might not get as much dietary fiber. And sometimes we may use it in medical settings to help with people that have altered stool consistency. So say someone has a looser stool consistency, it might not be uncommon for their medical provider to also use something like psyllium just to kind of give a little bit of bulk. But the idea is that moving that material through, although their mechanisms, their ways of working in the body are different, they are commonly used either one or the other, sometimes in combination, to help correct some abnormal bowel habit. And as far as whether or not they're safe to use in the long term, you know, I think that depends on a variety of things. And I mentioned one of them earlier, talking with Larry. You know, for example, if someone might have a new symptom that hasn't been investigated yet, or they're appropriate for colon cancer screening and that hasn't happened yet, we probably don't want to self-treat very long without getting those things addressed. And, you know, the hope is that it results in a study that's very reassuring. But that's one reason why a lot of the self-treatments with over-the-counter products might not always be a good idea. And that's also why a lot of these products that are available over-the-counter are labeled in such a way that, you know, they are discouraging people using them past a certain period of time, because the companies know that there might be other things that need to be evaluated. So it's not necessarily that you can't use some of these products for, say, more than 2 weeks or longer, but because the people selling them don't know that you, as a customer, don't have something that needs to be further evaluated, they kind of have to hedge and make some of those statements.
Makes sense.
You know, on their labeling.
Yeah, makes sense. Alfred, thank you for calling. Dr. Siegfried, you are our guest today, gastroenterologist with Amplify Health in La Crosse. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Great to have you along today on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. We are talking about digestive health today on the program with our guest, Dr. Siegfried Yu, gastroenterologist with Amplify Health in La Crosse. And you can join in 800-642-1234 or email to talk at WPR.org. Let's go to Kristen in Kenosha next. Hi, Kristen.
Hi.
What can we do for you?
Well, my son, he's 19 at this point. But for probably the last 6 or 7 years, he's had some poop problems.
Constipation problems, is it?
That is. He doesn't poop for 3 or 4 or 5 days. And then when he does, it winds up coming out as an extremely hard, like, I don't know, Nerf football size poop. And he gets a couple of them, and I'm very, very concerned that he's going to have his intestines or bowels or whatever get destroyed.
Yeah, that's interesting. Dr. Yu, what do you think?
You know, it sounds like he has a lot of symptoms, and I would say first and foremost, because we're not in exactly a medical setting, I would want him to make sure to see his healthcare provider and get that more specifically evaluated, and perhaps, you know, a consult with someone like me on the other side of the state might be useful. But having said that, in general, these types of problems, although we generally think about them as affecting people, say, in their 50s, 60s or later, I've seen many, many young people that I've had to help and treat, you know, suffer from them also. And that's where that medical evaluation becomes important, because we don't always want to assume that, you know, it's just that problem. That's generally something that the healthcare provider that meets him would be able to make some initial assessment on based on the history. But clearly, when it's causing this degree of dysfunction and it's bothersome, even if it doesn't end up being something more serious, I think your concerns are correct in that if it goes on like this and does not get addressed, even if we're not talking something more serious, like a specific diagnosis that could be in the realm of cancer or inflammatory bowel disease or something, you know, more unusual than that, the mechanical consequences and the quality of life consequences are real. And, you know, even if it ends up being a type of situation where we might give someone an impression of irritable bowel syndrome with constipation based on a combination of the symptoms they're struggling with and their primary bowel pattern, that in itself can be a big reason for people to miss work, not be able to excel in school or at their job. So the life lost in the form of quality is a problem also, and we don't always look at it that way. But particularly, I would say, for a young person still in that early stage of life, but really for anyone who wants to have a full life, these types of bowel issues are treatable. That's only the type of thing that can happen when you kind of seek help. And sometimes they can become more complicated, and not all providers may be as comfortable or as adept at figuring these problems out and getting someone to a point where, you know, they're better. Sometimes it could require more specialized testing. But, you know, in even a young person who has a lot of problems, at least some initial evaluation and testing could be appropriate. And I would say that captures a little bit about what we might review. And certainly family history is important. So in some families, especially in recent times, things like onset of colon cancer at younger ages, although 19 is a little extreme, but people say in their 30s, where we wouldn't even start thinking about it for a decade to screen this person. Sometimes we, sadly enough, may see younger people diagnosed earlier with, you know, even late stage cancers. So again, that kind of emphasizes the importance of making sure we're protecting our health and having those things looked at, particularly if we're in those groups based on our age demographic and other things, or just based on unexplained symptoms, you know, on a case-by-case basis. Those types of tests are there to clarify and guide, you know, what needs to be done to help them.
So probably a visit to the regular physician, but maybe with a referral to a gastroenterologist?
That's commonly where that would start, assuming that things just don't get better with some of the simple things we talked about earlier, like adequate fiber, water intake, activity. Part of the problem is just like any problem, you know, there are certain forms of, say, mild constipation that are relatively easy to correct. Some people might have more more severe issues. And in their extreme form, what they could sometimes result in, you know, might end up becoming surgical in nature, just because of the consequences on the gut. But I commonly would associate an uncorrected problem like constipation with other things that might be maybe easier for people to identify with, like symptomatic hemorrhoids, abdominal wall hernias, hiatal hernias, diverticulosis, things of that nature. I commonly see happen to people that have uncorrected bowel problems, even if we're not talking about a serious diagnosis like cancer or inflammatory bowel disease, for example.
Kristen, I hope that helps. Thank you very much for calling. I appreciate your call. And Dr. Yu, you mentioned irritable bowel disease. I mean, basically, what is it?
And I commonly will see that term, but generally, at least in my specialty, we will commonly use the term irritable bowel syndrome as opposed to disease. Okay. At least in our literature, that's kind of the way you describe it. And, you know, part of it is that especially when we use the term syndrome, we're describing, in this case, a combination of things like what are the symptoms and how does that help us classify what's going on. And in a similar vein, you know, with constipation being common, affecting up to, say, 15% of the population, and the 2024 statistics for the U.S., you know, we're 342 million people strong. Take 15% of that group, you know, may very well have constipation, and maybe more, depending on who is, you know, not diagnosed. And as far as irritable bowel syndrome, the statistics are very similar, so it's a large group of people affected. Generally, there will be some component of abdominal discomfort or abdominal pain and abnormal bowel habit. And, of course, among the bowel habits, we've talked a lot about constipation. That's one of them. And the other one would be diarrhea. But, you know, sometimes people with this type of problem, assuming there's not another explanation, may have mixed symptoms. So they could have alternating constipation and diarrhea, which sounds a little funny, but it's maybe more common than you would think. So, yeah.
Oh, all right. We had an email from just have a first initial E. Is 28, has IBS, combination type, was diagnosed at the age of 20, frequently very gassy and bloated to the point where it's painful and their pants don't fit. He occasionally takes simethicone, and it helps, but worries, are there negative health impacts to frequent use of this drug, simethicone?
Simethicone, I would say, I wouldn't be so much concerned as far as it causing long-term problems. And simethicone, for those that aren't as familiar with, it's a common over-the-counter medication. It's actually the chemical name of things that you might find labeled as Gas X or, you know, similarly telling names. But I would be probably more concerned about, as I mentioned earlier, about it not actually correcting the problem itself. And, you know, what that is actually causing in the form of lost quality of life, lost productivity, among other issues that I've, you know, reviewed a little bit here. So one thing I commonly see in my gastroenterology clinic is that occasionally when someone is given the label of irritable bowel syndrome of whatever type, you know, many people are given the impression that that's just what it is and there's nothing we can do about it. Although I tend to differ in that, you know, I do think there's commonly something underlying this that is probably something that is correctable. And until that's sort of looked at, it might be a premature conclusion to make that someone is sort of resigned to living this way for the rest of their life. And there is a role for being seen in a more specialized setting. And even within my own specialty, not all gastroenterologists might be as comfortable pursuing the more specific testing for people with functional bowel disorders in the realm of IBS. But there are occasionally more specific tests that can help us measure, say, how slow is the colon actually, or how dysfunctional is the pelvic floor at emptying, you know, among other things that you might run into.
Yeah. Let's take another call. Gianni in Montello will give you a chance. Hi, Gianni.
Yes. Good morning, Larry, and the good doctor. What a great topic. Listen, unfortunately, and I have to emphasize the qualifier, unfortunately, I took care of my parents for 16 years, and they were bedridden and wheelchair-ridden, and I had to make the transfers. And I found, yes, constipation to be a growing problem during their inactivity. So my solution was prune juice. Prunes per se, boiled prunes, and then corn. And if that didn't work on occasions, we would go to turmeric, however it's pronounced.
Turmeric, yeah.
And that, because it is not particularly water soluble, that would, you know, open up the bowels, and it actually caused loose bowels. So 500 milligrams after about 8 to 12 hours would bring about a bowel movement.
Hmm. Comment on that, Dr. Yu.
You know, that's interesting. It's not something we utilize a lot for that reason, but turmeric, which for people who aren't aware, it's the substance that you might find in a lot of the cuisine, South Asian cuisine, that we might describe as curry dishes. Mm-hmm. It's kind of gained popularity as an anti-inflammatory, and there are studies about it. Whether or not I would actually use it as a go-to for people that have some problems is so not something I've explored a whole lot. So that's interesting to hear that. But, you know, there's nothing wrong with using some of these more simple remedies if they do work. And, you know, one thing common to prunes and, you know, and the prune juice, of course, is the fructose content tends to be high. We tend to not absorb fructose as well because of the way it's in absorbed in our small intestines. And of course, the fiber component of the prune fruit, you know, is helpful. But a lot of people who are either immobile or totally bedridden and in the extreme would be, say, the person with a quadriplegia from a spinal cord injury that might be really, you know, in that position all day long. It can be very, very difficult to assist them with normal bowel habit. And it becomes a real priority also because of the consequences of them not emptying. So I'm glad that you're able to get a good response with those remedies. And I applaud you for being there for your parents.
Absolutely. Gianni, thank you so much for calling. And let's take a call from Molly in Madison. Hi, Molly.
Good morning, Larry. Good morning, doctor. I actually have a colonoscopy on the calendar for next week. And I was just curious if the doctor could talk through any common mistakes people might make in their preparation. Obviously, we get instructions and try to follow them, but I'm just curious if there's common errors that people make.
Hmm.
You know, I would say one of the the probably biggest mistakes one might make is how they're eating in the day before the colonoscopy. And when you think about what we're doing when we're trying to examine the colon as an organ, we need to be able to see the lining and detect things, sometimes small things, well, in a way that can protect you from cancer forming there later on. So the harder it is for us to see, the more difficult that task becomes. And because we're dealing with the colon, again, as an organ, whose job it is to form stool, the more residue that is left in the colon, the more difficult that job becomes, if it's possible at all. And so if someone, say, has a regular meal by accident that day before the colonoscopy, although there are some studies suggest you could perhaps have a breakfast and then go through your preparation, I would say we don't always know how everyone's bowel is going to respond. So, you know, somewhat non-apologetically, it's not uncommon for GI labs or procedure units to give standard instructions for everyone to increase the likelihood that everyone will be cleaned out well and get a good study in that regard. So that mistake of accidentally eating things that contain fibrous material, you know, is one of those mistakes that can be innocently made, especially when you're hungry are not used to fasting. But it's definitely important the day before, and depending on how difficult someone is to clean out, and sometimes you'll only know that after you've had one. Because it's not always obvious to a person that they might have a sluggish colon emptying function, one way they might realize it is if the day before their procedure, they notice they take, you know, usually we split the prep these days to make it easier on people and to get kind of a double wave effect. So they'll take the initial dose of the prep fluid that they've mixed, and they notice they have not had a bowel movement response. And sometimes it might even be later in the day before anything ever comes out. That's a sign that you might need a little more work to get empty. And, you know, you might even want to call the unit if they have an on-call person to let them know, I'm not sure I'm going to be prepared. Another issue is if someone vomits the prep. So not only is it not getting a response, but what's supposed to induce the response is out of the body once it gets vomited. That would be another thing to watch out for. But if it goes well, and I hope it goes very well for you, you know, what you should start to see is that the material coming out in the toilet should look as clear as urine or Mountain Dew might look like. You know, so that is a pretty good indicator that someone will be ready. It's not 100%, but it's far better than seeing a lot of residue, certainly, or a lot of cloudy fluid that's hard to see through. You just kind of have to imagine us trying to look through that fluid,
yeah,
finding things like precancerous polyps and that type of thing. And it might help to reduce the fiber intake even for a few days before the procedure. Or if you're a little constipated at baseline, taking Miralax maybe in the week before the test, just to make sure that you're a little more emptied before you start trying to clean it all out. And an analogy I commonly use, it's like cleaning one's house before they sell it. It's a lot easier for the person who's already got a spick and span house to get ready for the sale than it is for the someone who's hoarded a lot of material that's, you know, overflowing. It's not going to be so easy. And certainly with bowel function, I'm sure none of this is intentional. It's just what our bodies might be accustomed to, and until it really becomes important. Sometimes we don't realize that those types of things are an issue.
Molly, good luck. I very much appreciate your call and appreciate you listening in today. Thank you for listening in as we visit with Dr. Siegfried Yu. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Great to have you along today on WPR News as we talk about your digestive health with Dr. Siegfried Yu, gastroenterologist with Amplify Health in La Crosse. Let's take a call from Penelope in Madison next. Hi, Penelope.
Hi. So my question, I'm kind of piggybacking off the last person, Molly, who was asking about the colonoscopy.
Sure.
So I sort of struggle with hemorrhoids and have since I had had my daughter some 35 years ago, on and off. This isn't anything that is sort of, you know, life-threatening or anything. But my question is, my diet's great. Why am I struggling with this?
Hemorrhoids, Dr. Yu.
That's a good question. And I did mention it earlier briefly, that term pelvic floor dysfunction. And while certainly hemorrhoids definitely can flare during childbearing for women, you know, because of the changes in pressure and, of course, you know, the delivery and everything related to that that can damage the pelvic floor. Part of why, apart from that initial event, the hemorrhoids may become an ongoing issue is that some of the mechanism for that emptying function of the pelvic floor changes. And, you know, childbearing is one example, but other reasons for change in pelvic floor function could include back injuries, other abdominal or pelvic surgeries, among others. And one of the reasons for hemorrhoids to kind of flare or persist is related to that dysfunction or uncoordination of that floor. And if you kind of imagine that, you know, that when we say, when we use the term straining, part of what's happening is that when people strain, they're attempting to have a bowel movement and usually they're pushing. But what many might not realize is when we are pushing in such a way that's putting a lot of pressure to empty the pelvic floor, but that muscle that controls the opening of the floor, in this case, the anal sphincter, if it's not opening or relaxing well when it should, all that pressure that's being placed on that area has to go somewhere. And one of the places are the hemorrhoids. And I commonly tell my patients, you know, who ask me, like, oh, I didn't have hemorrhoids before. Why did I get this? And the term gets thrown around somewhat loosely, so sometimes I have to ask myself, what do they mean by that? Because, in fact, in normal human anatomy, the hemorrhoid plexus is the normal blood supply to the anal sphincter region. So we all are, technically, if we're human beings with normal anatomy, we all have them, but the opportunity for them to become symptomatic is usually kind of the issue. So occasionally, if they become severe enough and there's not something else that can be corrected, and, you know, I mentioned pelvic floor dysfunction because I'm a gastroenterologist that deals with some of those problems, and it can be tested for and rehabilitated sometimes without needing any medication. You just need a good pelvic floor physical therapist who's trained to do that, and there's some preliminary testing. But assuming those things are corrected, there's no obvious constipation issue, the pelvic floor issue is explored and addressed. Sometimes the hemorrhoids just have gotten to a point that seeing someone like a colorectal surgeon, at least in our system, we commonly refer patients with ongoing symptoms from hemorrhoids to them. And it doesn't necessarily mean they're going to take them out surgically. There are things that can be done even in a clinic setting where they can put these kind of medical-grade rubber bands on the internal hemorrhoids to reduce the degrees of prolapse or symptoms from them that can be considered. So hopefully that helps a little bit.
Penelope, thank you. And to go along with that, we had another email about what are exercises to strengthen your pelvic floor. And I would imagine your recommendation of seeing someone skilled in that area.
I would echo that. I think you're right. And one of the more confusing points when it comes to pelvic floor function, and I talk about this to my patients all the time, is most people are familiar with this type of exercise called Kegels exercises. Or Kegels, depending on how you pronounce it. A lot of times that's helpful when people have trouble with incontinence of stool. And it seems intuitive that the stronger you make those muscles, the better it should be. However, as I just described with, you know, that type of more specific problem affecting the emptying of the colon in the region of the anorectal area, it requires proper coordination. And sometimes it's not that the muscles are not strong enough. Sometimes the problem is that they're not cooperating. So if all we're doing is strengthening them, but our problem isn't actually weakness, we might actually not feel better. And, you know, in fact, we kind of need to be trained to allow it to relax at the proper time. And again, that is a more specific problem that probably needs, a little more specialized testing and or access to special types of pelvic floor physical therapists that are trained in that type of management. So.
And just to go along with that, Sue has wonders about an upper age for colonoscopy. She hasn't had any polyps for 15 years, and the one 15 years ago was small and benign. She's 71 with diverticulitis and worries about perforations with thinning intestinal walls. And in the last minute here.
Sure. And, you know, those concerns are valid. Based on our at least the gastroenterology guidelines, up to 75, and it's starting at age 45, we consider that group of people appropriate for screening. There are some varying guidelines with different societies, but particularly if you've had a history of precancerous polyps, as well as something like diverticulosis. And, you know, to clarify, when we use the term diverticulitis, that's an infected diverticulosis pocket. When we say diverticulosis, it's just the presence of those pockets in the colon or wherever. Kind of like having appendicitis is different from having an appendix. So to clarify that point, and it's not uncommon if someone gets a diverticulitis episode, we will recommend a colonoscopy just to be sure there's nothing else going on, like a big polyp that's clogged to the pocket or a tumor near that area. Although that's relatively uncommon, it could happen. And after age 85 in everyone, we generally stop standard screening and surveillance if we haven't already stopped. But depending how healthy one is, how motivated they are, if they're in that kind of 75 to 85-year-old demographic, you know, on a customized basis, we'll still consider it.
Dr. Yu, I want to thank you so much for being with us today. I hope we can get you back and talk more because we certainly didn't cover everything. Dr. Siegfried Yu, gastroenterologist with Amplify Health in La Crosse. Coming up, we're going to talk about how do you mend a broken heart. That next. I'm Larry Mueller.